Arizona's two U.S. senators think they have a solution to the flood of unaccompanied minors at the border. But the idea begins with finding ways to slow the flow.
I think everyone knows that there is violence in Guatemala, El Salvador, and Honduras, but we haven't seen a spike in violence or gang activity or murders that would justify the kind of flow that's coming.
I'm Mark Brody. Today on the show, another aspect of the immigration debate. Also, trying to get better info on dust storms. Arizona State unveils its uniform schedule for the upcoming football season, and that's a sentence you probably would not have heard a few years ago. And there's a desert plant that blooms in the summer.
It's a lovely tourist attraction that we'd love to be able to take more advantage of, but unfortunately, nature doesn't always let us in on our plans.
Plus, art from back in the day and talking back at the theater. That and more ahead on the show after a check of this hour's news. Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody. Steve Goldstein is away. Look for partly sunny skies across the valley for the rest of this afternoon with a high of 106, mid-80s for a low tonight. Partly sunny skies again tomorrow with a high of 110. No mention of storms again until at least Sunday. Right now, sunny skies, 104 degrees at KJZZ. A judge ruled today that public schools in the state are entitled to at least $317 million in additional funding for inflation this year. That after lawmakers and the governor had stopped funding part of a voter-approved annual increase for inflation. Joining me now to talk about the ruling and its impact is KJZZ's Stina Sieg. Hi, Stina.
Hello.
So folks in education have been saying for a while that lawmakers were not legally allowed to stop the funding. What are they saying today about the ruling?
Well, they're saying that they're happy about it, but they also expected it. And they're also saying that it's not going to solve the problem of school funding. You know, Arizona schools are some of the lowest funded schools in the entire country. And they're saying this is just a help, but the problem is much, much larger. Chuck Essigs, he's with the Arizona Association of School Business Officials. And he said that, you know, the problem of how you're going to fund this, that they're willing to work with the legislature on that issue.
You know, we've been saying for years that we're willing to work with the legislature to look at how resources would be available to adequately fund schools in Arizona.
So, Stina, this is obviously money that lawmakers and the governor had not budgeted for in their spending plan for the fiscal year that started just a couple of weeks ago. So where do legislators think the money to pay for this now will come from?
I don't think that they know. I spoke with Representative John Kavanaugh today, and he was very open about the fact that the future seems unclear. For this year, he didn't sound as worried because there are options. You know, there's the Rainy Day Fund that has about $450 million in it. That would more than cover the additional dollars for schools. But he says, you know, what about next year? What about the year after? That's what he's concerned about.
The restorations, for the most part, have been made already. So this will be gravy on top. I'm not saying the schools don't need it. But when we confronted this type of a shortfall back at 10, we had a lot of funds we could sweep. And we were able to cut from all agencies. You take that off the table for cuts, it's going to be extremely difficult to balance the budget.
That was House Appropriations Committee Chairman John Kavanaugh. I've been speaking with KJZZ's Stina Sieg. Stina, thanks.
Thank you.
Arizona Senators Jeff Flake and John McCain are introducing legislation aimed at addressing the child migrant crisis. Joining me in studio is KJZZ's Jude Jaffe Block to talk about it. Hi, Jude.
Hi there.
So, Jude, the senators clearly want to deter more kids from coming. Senator McCain says the crisis will continue until parents see plane loads of kids landing back home and they realize the money they paid smugglers was a waste. So what exactly are McCain and Flake proposing happen here?
Well, one of the things they're proposing is a change to a 2008 anti-trafficking law. And right now, that law means that it's a lengthy process to deport kids from non-contiguous countries like Central America. On the other hand, kids who come unaccompanied from Mexico can be sent back much more quickly. Flake and McCain think Central American kids should be treated the same as Mexican kids are now. I spoke to Senator Flake about that proposal.
Right now, if a Mexican national or an unaccompanied minor from Mexico comes across the border, they are taken by the Border Patrol, and then they are given an administrative hearing. And if there is a credible claim of persecution, then that child can be in protective care. If there is not, if they're just coming across the border, then they can be repatriated with their parents or back to Mexico. We have an agreement with Mexico. And the average time it takes is just 3 days. If you contrast that with, say, a child coming from Honduras, that child, according to this law passed in 2008, has to appear before an immigration judge. Because the docket is so full, that could be 9 months or a year or longer. And so that child has to be detained or placed with a family here in the United States. And the problem is very few then actually show up for the hearing later. And I have to say, when the law was passed in 2008, this kind of loophole wasn't envisioned. People didn't think that it would be used for this purpose, but the smugglers have exploited it. They advertise it. And so that's why we have so many children coming.
Yeah, and I mean, some critics of the idea of changing the law say they're concerned because currently with Mexican nationals, the process involves a screening with a Border Patrol agent rather than the full immigration judge experience, and maybe the children haven't had access to an attorney and don't understand their rights. Maybe some of them have been traumatized or aren't good at articulating what they're going through, and so there's a fear that some are returned who actually might have a valid reason to stay or a valid immigration relief claim. I mean, do you share any of those concerns with this process, or is there any way to address that, or are some of these concerns misguided?
It's not as if they come and present a claim and are simply ignored. They are given a chance to make that allegation. And so it's not an automatic return. Some children, some Mexican national children will stay. But what's happening now is these kids are coming with their parents or coming to join parents. These smugglers have them in their care for a week or two or three or more. That's far more dangerous, I would submit, than other things that we could do. And what we've got to do is stop that incentive and stop this flow northward. I think everyone knows that there is violence in Guatemala, El Salvador, and Honduras. But we haven't seen a spike in violence or gang activity or murders that would justify the kind of flow that's coming. In fact, Border Patrol interviewed 250 people who crossed just in a two-week period, and 95% of them gave as their primary reason for coming across the belief that they would be given some kind of legal status here. So it's clearly being driven by things other than violence or gang activity in those countries.
Now, you're not the only one who had the idea of changing this part of the law. This is something the Obama administration has also floated. How do you think this is going to be received by your colleagues in Congress?
Well, I was excited when I heard the president was saying that we need to change the law, or he needed more authority and flexibility to deal with these unaccompanied minors. He's since kind of backed away a bit, and there are some in Congress who are saying that they don't think that there needs to be any change to the law. So I agree with the president's original position. He ought to have that authority. And when you look at the request that was made for additional funds, for emergency funds, $1.8 billion of it, so far more than half of the immigration-related funds, goes to HHS. HHS obviously has no role at the border. Their role is to warehouse and then place these children. And the clear message sent is a very dangerous one. That message to the cartels and the human smugglers is, keep them coming, because we're going to treat future arrivals just like we're treating those now. And I would submit that that's the least humane thing that we could do, and we can't go that direction.
That was Arizona Senator Jeff Flake speaking with KJZZ's Jude Joffe Blanc. Jude is still in studio with me here. And Jude, did Senator Flake say anything about the fact that at the same time we're hearing reports that some of these kids really are fleeing danger at home? Does anything in the legislation address that?
Yeah, so the legislation has a few points to it. And one is to make more refugee visas available at the U.S. consulates in Honduras, Guatemala, and El Salvador. And that means people there who are fearing persecution could go to their local U.S. consulate and potentially apply for asylum. and do it in country rather than making the really dangerous journey here and then applying. So it'll be really interesting to see how that proposal is received.
KJZZ's Jude Joffe Block. Jude, thanks.
Thank you.
Earlier this week, ASU professor Ursula Orr pleaded guilty to a misdemeanor count of resisting arrest, stemming from a much-publicized incident in which she was arrested by a campus police officer while crossing the street. Orr then refused to provide ID. Her attorney said Orr pleaded to passively resisting arrest. Jalila Jefferson Bollock teaches criminal law at Arizona Summit Law School and says the law sets out three ways in which someone can resist arrest.
One is by using or threatening to use physical force against a peace officer. Another is by using any other means that could create a substantial risk of causing physical injury to a peace officer. And another is by engaging in passive resistance. And the differences are that the first two instances would be felony crimes. Resisting arrest by engaging in passive resistance would be a misdemeanor offense.
That sounds kind of subjective, passively resisting arrest. I mean, are there specific things that have to be done in order to meet that threshold?
There is specific language that's in the statute, and the statute makes it clear that passive resistance is going to occur when the defendant engages in a nonviolent physical act or failure to act that's intended either to impede, to hinder, or somehow delay the effecting of the arrest. So the difference would really be the lack of violence for passive resistance.
So if an officer tries to arrest me and I just sit myself down on the ground and let them do it, but I don't help them in any way, that could possibly be considered a passively resisting arrest.
That's exactly correct. You know, you'd still be charged with resisting arrest, but you could avail yourself of having done so by engaging in passive resistance, which, of course, if in fact you were found liable, you were found guilty, that would be a much better outcome for you than the other two instances.
Is having a law about passively resisting arrest pretty common among the states?
I think that it is. I think that many states do demonstrate a difference in their statutory language between how an individual is treated when they're thought to have used violence or force in resisting arrest, and when they do so without that type of violence or force. Yes, I do believe that's true.
Are any of the three forms of resisting arrest more prevalent in your mind?
I would guess that usually when a police officer charges a person with resisting arrest, it's usually going to be because there's been some sort of physical act involved in it, usually. And so when a person is going to passively resist, that'll be few and far between. Most likely, a person would be charged with resisting arrest under subsections 1 and 2, and they would plead it down to 3. You see what I mean?
So they would be charged with one of the violent ones and plead down to the passive one.
Most likely, yeah. The likelihood that the initial charge would be engaging in passive resistance is going to be very, very, very small.
Jalila Jefferson Bullock is an assistant professor of law at Arizona Summit Law School. Still to come, we now know which uniforms ASU's football team will wear from week to week this coming season, and no, it's not as simple as home and road.
More and more, there is a feeling that the more uniforms you have, somehow the more legitimate you are, that you're one of the cool kids.
Get your calendar ready. That's ahead. It's the show. Quick check of Valley Roadways, an accident 101 northbound in the East Valley. It's at Frank Lloyd Wright and has the shoulder blocked. Also an accident I-10 eastbound blocking the shoulder at State Route 143. Look for partly sunny skies across the valley for the rest of this afternoon with a high of 106. We hit 105 yesterday. Partly cloudy skies on the way for tonight with overnight lows in the mid-80s. And it'll be partly sunny again tomorrow and warmer with a high of 110. It's 104 degrees at 219.
KJZZ is supported by Ironwood Cancer and Research Centers, with cancer centers in the East Valley, Phoenix, and Scottsdale. Ironwood Cancer and Research Centers, outsmarting cancer one patient at a time. More at ironwoodcrc.com.
This is K. KJZZ, I'm John Huckenberry.
And I'm Mark Brody. There's a crisis over the availability of water around the world.
The group of women say the municipality has failed them after numerous promises to supply them with water. Police moved in when the protesters started undressing. Residents have barricaded entrances to the village, preventing tankers from entering.
Sounds of anger there from across the globe, particularly in South Asia, and especially in America, where there is a water crisis that has only gotten worse since the beginning of 2014. And of course, you have a voice in all this.
Hi, my name's Daryl Willis. I'm from West Palm Beach, Florida. And I wanted to say, on this planet, in this age, clean water is unfortunately a privilege. It's not a matter of philosophy, it's just economics. Clean water is a commodity, whether or not we like that fact. And until such time as demand no longer outweighs supply, it will be treated and traded as such.
A drought emergency in the state of California has been in place for months. According to the Government Accountability Office, even under normal water conditions, water managers in as many as 40 states are already anticipating serious water shortages over the next 10 years. In an attempt to stay out in front of this huge but slow-moving crisis, we've been carrying on a conversation over the past several months with expert David Sedlak, co-director of the Berkeley Water Center and author of Water 4.0, The Past, Present, and Future of the World's Most Vital Resource. Welcome back to The Takeaway, David.
Thanks for having me, John.
So, David, let's talk just a little bit about where things stand in California. You hear Governor Brown talking about water every other day. He's now right in the center of this immigration crisis. It almost sounds like he's running for president, the old days of 1980. Anything reminiscent to you?
Oh, it definitely seems like old times are back again, and having Jerry Brown there makes it feel like the previous water crisis. But there's a difference this time, and that's that we have a lot more experience in how to deal with our water problems, and we have more technologies to try to come up with new ways of sourcing water that don't rely upon imported water.
What's the update that you would give us that's sort of a takeaway halfway through 2014, really 6 months after Jerry Brown declared this state of emergency in California, and we've seen similar impacts in other states in the American West?
Well, it's certainly still dry here in California, and the farmers are really struggling with the water availability and their low allocations of water from the state and federal water projects. But the good news is that the cities in California are feeling pretty confident in their ability to survive and keep going over the next few years.
What about institutional changes that would a deal with tensions between agricultural users of water, which often have favorability over residential users of water? Those can be tense depending upon which state and locality you are in. How have you resolved that in the state of California, and what lessons are to be learned around the United States going forward?
John, I'm sorry to say that I don't think we've made a great deal of progress in our discussions about water rights and the need for water for agriculture, cities, and the environment. And so I think we're going to have to find other ways for cities to provide themselves with water, because the politics behind water transfers and water rights are complex and not easily resolved.
Have we ever asked the fundamental sort of civic question in the United States, whether water is a political right to a citizen of a country, or whether it constitutes some sort of commodity where it's a privilege if you live close to it, if you're smart enough to live close enough to it, if you're lucky enough to live close enough to it, that sort of thing?
I think we've done that in the courts, and we've done that in the political process. And to me, the question of right or privilege isn't the right one to be asking. It's really the fact that water is a necessity. And I think increasingly we're realizing that it's an economic necessity. That is, if cities want to continue to grow and have the kinds of be the kinds of places that people expect them to be, they need access to a secure source of water for the long term.
So water as a necessity, and trying to get this into some sort of political context, does politics sort of cloud that issue of necessity? Or how would you rank water in terms of the way that we deal constantly with issues like education in politics? A viable and vibrant educational system in a community is certainly a means for driving growth in that community. How can water be conveyed as a similar sort of driver of growth in a community?
Well, when businesses suspect that a city doesn't have a viable source of water in the long term, they're going to be hesitant to locate there and invest there. And so one has to think not only about water in a time of crisis, we have to think about the water supply on the timescale of decades, because that's really how long it takes to create a new water source or to make a conservation program really have the impact that we want it to have. And so if we're not serious about water, then the jobs that we want in our cities won't come there. And the ones that are there will think about other places to go where there's a more secure water supply.
And the disheartening takeaway there is that our political system is not really great at working on a long time scale like that. David Sedlak, co-director of the Berkeley Water Center and author of Water 4.0, The Past, Present, and Future of the World's Most Vital Resource. Thanks so much, David.
Thank you, John.
That's the Takeaways, John Hockenberry.
With early voting for Arizona's primary election less than a month away, campaign signs can take on extra significance in increasing name recognition or getting some voters to pay a little bit more attention. But why do they look so much alike? How does that help people who are running for office stand out? Rick Debus is the CEO of Signazon.com, which has offices in Dallas and New York, but designs signs for candidates around the country. He says the first key is to keep it simple.
So many candidates want to put their whole life story and tell them how great they are on these signs. And doing what the big dogs do is kind of the more important thing, and that's really keeping it simple. You have kind of two things that you want to focus on, and that's brand and the message you're trying to display.
And when you think simple, are we saying the name, a quick message, maybe make it clear what party they're with?
Well, the first thing you want to try to do is you want to focus primarily on brand recognition, which is the name part. No one votes for someone they can't recognize. And so you want to focus on the name and then deciding on what colors you want to display. And again, trying to fall in line with what's simple. If you're Republican, then focusing on the red. And then if you're Democrat, focusing on the blue.
But Rick, why do they have to use these predictable colors?
You want to play into what the major campaigns, they spend millions and millions of dollars to really show the effectiveness of these political campaign signs. And if you go outside of that realm, you're inviting alienation of your voters and doing something kind of outside that. And I think we all kind of drive up to a intersection and we'll see just all of these campaign signs on the side of the road. And I can say that I don't even remember one of those names. And so it's really about the environment that you're in. And so ideally to stand out, hopefully you're the only sign on that corner or that block or in that particular area.
What's new? Are there any changes coming to campaign signs?
There's a kind of a secret trick right now that's in the market. The printing world has advanced quite a bit in the past 4 years or so. Mm. And you may have seen a couple of different types of political campaign signs out there in the market, which are different than the previous years. You probably drive by and you're going to start seeing a lot more faces. So full color sign is that you're going to see quite a lot more. And the reason behind that is, one, again, to stand out, because if you look at all those corners, you're going to see so many single color or two color signs, and they just completely blend out. You're not going to see or recognize really anybody. And so the candidates that have these signs, we get calls so often from these candidates saying that those signs with the full color and the face on, they really believe that they made a huge difference just getting those signs out in front of the voters. That's really how you should be effectiveness and standing out. It's the brand in your face. So you can stand out right now by putting your face on your signage.
Rick Debus is the CEO of Signazon.com.
It's the show. I'm Kendra Sabo. I produce some of the audio vignettes you hear each week, and these are the sounds of the city.
I'm Rebecca Murillo, and I'm enjoying this Arizona weather with a morning hike. We took advantage of this cloudy weather because it's rare that it is this cloudy. Out of all these mountains in Thunderbird, this is the smallest one, and we haven't gone hiking in quite a bit, so we decided to just take it easy and do this small one. When you're on top of the mountain, it's kind of like a feeling of, you know, being above everything else. So kind of like that euphoria and freedom kind of a feeling. Especially like right now when this wind is blowing, on the top of the mountain. It feels really good.
Rebecca Murillo hiking with her husband and daughter at Thunderbird Conservation Park in Glendale. If you have suggestions or hear things that make Phoenix, well, Phoenix, send us a note. The show at kjzz.org. Good afternoon. You're listening to the show on KJZZ. Quick check of Valley traffic. 101 northbound in the East Valley, the accident at Frank Lloyd Wright now blocking the shoulder. Elsewhere, an accident I-10 eastbound also blocking the shoulder, that at the State Route 143. Well, what you see outside right now is what we're expecting for the rest of the day. Partly sunny skies with a high of 106. Some clouds might start to roll in by tonight. Look for overnight lows in the mid-80s. Start to the weekend will be partly sunny as well, but a bit warmer with a high of 110. Right now, it's 104 degrees at KJZZ at 2:30.
KJZZ is supported by Solar Tops, an Arizona-based SunPower Elite dealer, helping homeowners to reduce electricity usage with turnkey solar solutions. More about options to purchase, finance, or lease a system at solartopps.com.
An astonishing quarter of the world's mammals and 41% of amphibians are now threatened with extinction, according to the International Union for the Conservation of Nature. They've assessed some 71,000 different species of animals, but say that figure needs to be more than doubled to get a real picture of the global threat to wildlife. So how do you go about counting wild animals? Every year, a group of international students converges on the Smithsonian's Conservation Biology Institute in a remote part of Virginia to learn how. The BBC's Jane O'Brien has the story.
Great. Try to get a hold on the animal carefully.
Out in the woods near the Blue Ridge Mountains of Virginia, international wildlife students inspect their rodent traps.
And remember, like Joe showed you yesterday, you want to open the door and then twist the trap a little bit, and that'll stay open. And these guys are very, very active, so. There he is.
The course is held at the Smithsonian's Conservation Biology Institute, where endangered species such as the Mongolian wild horse are bred in captivity. Course leader and Smithsonian zoologist Chris Helgen says the techniques for monitoring mice can be applied to other wildlife.
This is called the Mongolian wild horse, and wild horses have become extinct all across Asia and Europe in recent centuries. Remote areas of Mongolia were some of the last outposts for the wild horse.
We've just watched you trapping mice and measuring their tails and weighing them. What on earth has that got to do with preserving animals like this?
Well, we're trying to figure out how many mice there are, and that's the connection. So the students learn by exercises with mice and bobcats and deer how to count different kinds of animals in a landscape. Seems very simple. It's very hard to get that kind of information.
Carefully clip that soft clip on the base of the tail. Perfect. Great. So it doesn't squeeze it too hard, but it's going to hold it firm when we try to get a weight.
But simply understanding animals and their habitats isn't enough to ensure their survival. How, for instance, do you encourage an extremely rare white-naped crane to breed when she's fallen in love with a human?
She has a nest back there, and she's behaving defensively and aggressively toward us in defense of her nest. Even though she is imprinted on people, now that she has established basically a pair bond with one of my keepers, that is now her mate. And if anyone else goes in there, she will actually become aggressive and attack them.
Birdkeeper Warren Lynch is describing what happens when a wild bird associates a little too closely with people. Walnut is 35 years old, and because she was hand-reared, she has no interest in other cranes. Only her keeper can tickle her fancy, which means he has to artificially inseminate her if she has any chance of breeding. But experts say fewer than half the world's species are being effectively monitored, and that's a problem, says National Zoo ecologist Bill McShay.
We don't know about most of these animals. We don't know what time of year they breed. Do they need two males to every one female, or do they need four females for every one male? Do the females need to see the males first, or do they need to just come upon them on a certain day? It's not learn one thing and then just cookie cut that to everything else, because they're unique species.
And that's why conservationists around the world need to do the basics, which means, among other things, learning how to count mice.
Okay, back in the trap, and we can put them right back where we found them.
That's the BBC's Jane O'Brien reporting. Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody. The valley's brief respite from dust storms could come to an end in the next few days. Cell phones have been ringing with dust storm warnings, and Ken Waters says there are a few factors that go into issuing one. He's the warning meteorologist for the National Weather Service in Phoenix and says he needs to know the current conditions and whether strong winds are possible. Waters says the big dust storm areas tend to be along I-10 near Picacho Peak and I-8 west of Casa Grande.
We're looking for just strong enough winds that they can be able to pick up that dust and be able to transport it.
So given that most of the areas you're looking at are a little bit away from the valley, is that helpful in terms of giving you more time to decide, yes, this is something we need to do, and if so, it'll give people more time to sort of adjust their plans?
Well, it's certainly, as far as the Phoenix metropolitan area, gives us more heads up, you know, because we can see weather coming. But there's definitely a disadvantage in the sense that our observational capability is much lower out there. It's further from our weather radar, and we have fewer observing stations and people that can send in reports to us. So that makes it a lot more problematic for us.
Is there any chance you could get more reporting stations in those areas?
You know, that's something that we definitely strive for. We very actively recruit volunteer spotters out there, and with the hope of getting some of those early reports so that we know right away that we have a dust storm out there. In addition, we're actually working on a novel little program to set up a dust detection network using low-cost hardware that's available out there, and we're setting up some prototypes just this summer, so hoping to basically electronically detect when you have the dust storm and then to send that up into the cloud.
How would that work?
Basically, it's measuring particulate matter in the air. And as soon as it detects like an alert type condition, which is sort of like what you have when the dust storm comes through, it would send it up to the cloud and to a place where not only the National Weather Service, but also the first responders out there and some of the agencies that really are key into this, things like ADOT and DPS, give them that heads up that, hey, something's going on out there.
That sounds somewhat similar to what an agency like the Maricopa County Health Department or the State Health Department would use to detect if it's a high pollution day or something.
Right. Now, there are agencies that do have air quality sensors out there, but there's very few of them, and, you know, there's a lot of expense that goes into that, and so you can't have a really dense network. So what we're looking at is setting up a dense network of volunteers, basically.
When you're looking at calling for a dust storm warning, are there certain metrics that actually have to be met?
There is one quantitative measure that we do use, and that's visibility. We consider it to be a dust storm when it hits a quarter mile or below as far as the visibility goes. The key, of course, is we don't want to tell people there's a dust storm out there. We want to tell people that we think there's going to be a dust storm. We want to get that heads up. So that's the ideal. That doesn't always happen. A lot of times we do get that report, and we have to issue a dust storm warning very quickly.
Ken Waters is the warning meteorologist for the National Weather Service in Phoenix. ASU this week laid out its uniform combinations for the upcoming football season. Now, not to sound all old fogey or anything, but there was a time when a team had a home uniform and a road uniform, and we all knew which one it'd wear for each game. That time, however, has passed. Paul Lucas writes about uniform and logo design for ESPN.com and his own site, Uniwatch.com.
More teams have more uniform styles, more designs. It used to be you pretty much had two uniforms, you know, your home uniform and road uniform, and now teams have any number of alternates and special occasion uniforms, and in the world of college football, teams usually just had one helmet, and now teams will have three, four, even five or six helmets.
Why are they doing that?
I think part of it is a reflection of what you might call our short attention span society, and the cycle of change is much faster in the uniform world. Teams used to change their uniforms once a generation, and then it was once a decade, and then it was every 5 years, and now it's, for many teams, every year or even every game. And fans get sort of itchy if there's not a new design put in front of them on an ever-increasing or ever-faster time cycle. Part of it certainly is merchandising, not so much with helmets because people don't buy replica helmets, but they do buy replica jerseys, and so the more jerseys a team wears, that's the, you know, every new design you put on the field is a new design you can sell.
So just a few years ago, Arizona State unveiled its new uniforms with a new logo and a new color scheme and everything, and this week they unveiled the combinations of uniforms that they would be wearing for their home games this year.
Yeah, is this something their uniform schedule. So
right, yeah. I mean, is this something that a lot of schools are doing?
More and more schools are doing it. Some schools will put on their season tickets, you know, if you're a season ticket holder and you get your pack of tickets, and it will say on the tickets what color jersey the team is going to wear for a given home game. And the idea there is that the fans are requested or even expected to dress up in that same color. So you can have that, you know, the blackout game or the whiteout game or the goldout game or whatever color it might be.
It's hard to look at stuff like this and not be somewhat cynical and say, you know, the schools are just trying to make more money, that, you know, the more uniforms they have, the more, as you said, jerseys they can sell, the more T-shirts they can sell, the more merchandise they can sell. Is there something in this for the fans other than, you know, being able to see change on a weekly or perhaps on a season-by-season basis?
What does the fan get out of it? I think sort of overriding all of this and kind of woven in with all those other reasons or you know, levels of appeal for the fan gets this feeling of legitimacy for the team, that there is now this feeling that, rightly or wrongly, that a big-time school has lots of uniforms and that it's only the little schools or the old-fashioned schools or the schools who aren't with it that stick to just a basic home and road design. More and more, there is a feeling that the more uniforms you have, somehow the more legitimate you are, that you're one of the cool kids. We could debate or discuss whether that's kind of a legitimate thing or more of an impression or an illusion even. But I do think that that is the feeling many fans have.
Paul Lucas writes about uniform and logo design for ESPN.com and his site, Uniwash.com.
This is the best burrito I've ever eaten. Yum, yum, yum.
You may have heard about the search for the best burrito in the country, which is being led by statistician Nate Silver's blog 538. That search got us thinking about the best burrito in the Valley. So we're on the hunt, leaving no burrito unfolded or unbitten. But we need your help. Tell us your favorite burrito in town by emailing us at theshow@kjzz.org. It just might end up with the coveted title, official winner of the KJZZ Best Burrito Bonanza 2014.
This is the best burrito I've ever eaten. Yum, yum, yum.
Remember the good old days? You know, all the way back in the 90s? Visual artist Noelle Martinez does, kind of. She's only 24, but says 90s culture has played a big role in her life.
First started with my mom, her listening to Sade, Mary J. Blige, that type of soul music, and then that transcended to my brothers, and from there my brothers, you know, showed me the way, because I've learned drawing and everything from them, so music came along with it.
That combo is the basis for Martinez's first gallery exhibit called Back in the Days, opening tomorrow night at Willow North Gallery in Phoenix. It depicts Afrocentric music from the 90s. Her paintings are a mixture of album covers, lyrics, and portraits. Martinez says those were her biggest challenge.
Trying to represent those artists who are now dead, it's, you know, it's a big deal. I think a lot of visual artists have tried this, and so if you're going to do it, you have to do it right. And that was the biggest challenge for me, but yeah, I'm really pleased with how they're turning out.
When you listen to some of the music from that time, some of the rap artists, the hip-hop artists, do the messages stay the same to you now that from what you heard back when you were a kid?
I think if anything, they're more enhanced now. I actually understand what people are saying and what they're talking about. And I can understand how much more creative people were back then in the music industry than they are now. You know, before I was a kid, I was listening to the music and I liked it because of the sound and everything. But now I can see like where they're really coming from and how much they're creating. They're doing what they love, and you can really hear it in their music.
Martinez acknowledges she's a little young to remember a lot of the music from the 90s, but points to the baseball hat and basketball shorts she wears and has worn since she was a kid as proof of the impact the decade has had on her.
The 90s is definitely involved. It's all around us today. So I think, but I just don't feel like people give a tribute to it. I think they think that it's like people are creating that now, but there's so much that was happening back then that people are doing now, they don't realize it, especially the younger generation. And maybe I am a part of this younger generation, but I at least can recognize where all these references are coming from.
Looking around her Phoenix studio west of downtown, it's kind of a who's who of 90s rap and hip-hop. Portraits of Tupac Shakur and Notorious B.I.G., a painting of Dr. Dre, and Martinez's take on the song Shorty Wanna Be a Thug by Tupac. Shorty wanna be a thug, said he wanna be, said he wanna
be, said he wanna be, shorty's gonna be a thug. The character is a Khalil from Bebe's Kids, which is another, it's a 90s animated film. And I did the actual character, but I changed his clothes, so he has the clothes from Doughboy and Boys in the Hood, the motion picture. And he's being arrested like he's being arrested in the actual motion picture. And that was just, that was an idea that I came up, one of the first ideas I came up with on doing the show. And I wanted a lot of them to be my own creation, not just straight from the lyrics or movies or whatever it was. So having those three different references from the 90s, I thought really brought it all together.
Martinez's exhibit, Back in the Days, opens tomorrow night at Willow North Gallery in Phoenix. And yes, she says there will be some of her favorite music playing. Shorty wanna be a thug, gonna be, said he's gonna be, one day he's gonna be. Shorty's gonna be a thug, said he's gonna be. Good afternoon. You're listening to the show on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody. The show is bringing you more from our community, along with national and international news, of a full compendium of all that's going on in our community. Quick check of Valley traffic. I-10 eastbound, an accident at the 143 is blocking the shoulder. 101 northbound in the East Valley, an accident blocking the shoulder at Frank Lloyd Wright. Partly sunny skies continuing throughout the afternoon. Look for a high of 106 today. It'll be partly cloudy tonight with overnight lows in the mid-80s. It'll be partly sunny and hot tomorrow with a high of 110. It's 104 degrees at 247.
Summer is here. If you're purchasing a new vehicle for your summer road trip, donate your old vehicle to KJZZ. It's a great way to support programs like Morning Edition and Marketplace. We'll use the proceeds to bring you all the programs you love, and you'll receive a tax deduction. Just visit cars.kjzz.org, and thanks.
As the monsoon is gaining steam, another season is coming to an end. This is the time of year Valley residents may be lucky enough to see a queen of the night in bloom. Tracy Rhodes is the gardener in charge of the Center for Desert Living Trail at the Desert Botanical Gardens.
The queen of the night will bloom anywhere from late May through late July. And really, honestly, we're still trying to sort out when they decide to bloom. It's kind of a big mystery, just given the nature of how and when they do their blooming. Part of that being that the queen of the nights in any given area will tend to all bloom, well, they will all bloom on the same night of the year. And we still don't quite understand how they coordinate it.
What do we know about that?
Not much. Researchers have been looking at it for about 20 years, and they're still a little puzzled as to how they're able to kind of coordinate their efforts, given that the buds develop over a several-week period. We think it's probably biochemical. There's some sort of signal they give out to each other, but we're still trying to sort out how.
Now, these are flowers that bloom for one night, basically, and one time a year. Can you describe for us what they look like and what they smell like?
Absolutely. They're beautiful. They're extraordinary. It will start, you know, the bud is a couple inches big, and it will start blooming right after dusk, right around dusk, and slowly open over the course of the evening. By the middle of the night, it's fully open. It can be up to 6 inches in diameter, bright white, just a gorgeous flower. And the scent it puts out is very, very potent. It reminds me of maybe a combination of jasmine with a little vanilla, but just intoxicating. It's a beautiful scent. And when there are a bunch of them blooming in the same area, it's just kind of extraordinary to witness.
And by the morning, they're kind of starting to shrivel up again, right?
And by morning and by dawn, they're starting to close up again. And usually by 8 or 9 a.m., that's all she wrote. They won't be back, and that's their season.
No, obviously these flowers are very beautiful. I mean, if you look at a picture of it, it's hard not to come to that conclusion. But I'm wondering if there's sort of like an economic factor at work with the popularity of these, sort of a supply and demand where, you know, you can see a rose, which is beautiful also. You can see that any old time. But these flowers bloom one night and then they're gone. I mean, is there sort of a shortage, a supply problem here that people really want to see these and know they have such a limited time to get to it?
It is a little frustrating because people do hear about them. They're so renowned. I mean, they're so famous for how beautifully they, you know, light up, you know, the air around them and with their scent and how beautiful they are in general. It is really, it's a lovely tourist attraction that we'd love to be able to take more advantage of, but unfortunately nature doesn't always let us in on her plans, and, you know, we just kind of have to treat it as serendipity. I mean, we definitely have our queens of the night marked in the garden. We've got signage on them because they are hard to see. They tend to grow up into bushes, and they themselves, like I said, look just like a little twig or a very skinny, dull antler sticking out of the ground, so you wouldn't tend to notice them by themselves. You know, or even, you know, they're hard to find even in the wild, you know, and if somebody knows of one in a given desert, they'll probably, you know, consider themselves lucky and watch it carefully.
Tracy Rhodes is the gardener in charge of the Center for Desert Living Trail at the Desert Botanical Gardens. And by the way, Tracy told us DBG had some blooms just last night. You can see photos of them at kjzz.org. It's one of the most popular mountains in the valley. Known for its difficult hiking trails and unique shape, the centrally located mountain also has a few interesting areas to visit. KJZZ's Nadine Arroyo-Rodriguez takes us hiking.
Surrounded by private property, Camelback Mountain stands 1,500 feet high. It's regulated by the City of Phoenix Parks and Recreation Department. Did you know part of Camelback Mountain is more than a billion years old and is chock full of prime sightseeing spots?
It's in the hub of the city. You know, 20 minutes from downtown, you're right here. It's the highest peak in the city of Phoenix, so 2706.
Cody Huggins is the Phoenix Ranger who took me on a hiking tour.
Up here, you know, there's a lot of climbing. Climbing dates back to the early 40s here.
Camelback Mountain got its name from those two humps you can spot from pretty much anywhere in the city. It resembles a kneeling camel facing west. From head to end, it's about 2 miles long. This city park has two hiking trails. Both are steep and strenuous. We're on Echo Canyon Trail near McDonald Drive. Huggins says there's more to this mountain than just hiking. He points to the mountain floor line below the camel's head.
This over here has some Native American history. The Hohokam used this for ceremonies.
It's a cavern-like opening known as the Ceremonial Grotto. The cavern ceiling rises to about 50 feet high. Its arch wall makes it feel like you're in a symphony band shell. The sounds echo off the sedimentary rock. Huggins says that's where the Echo Canyon Trail got its name. He cautions me as we walk inside.
What are you trying to tell me?
I'm going
to
give you a hint.
That's ginormous.
I know, it's really big, right?
The giant beehive makes me want to go. We scurry off and make our way to a structure known as the Praying Monk. It's a 100-foot rock formation on the north side of the mountain that, from a distance, resembles someone praying.
You can't just walk up to the Praying Monk. That would require technical, it's a technical climb. You know, it requires rope and gear.
But you can get close enough to see how big it is and the view around it. Looking out to the east and west in the distance, there are at least 11 other mountains in sight. When Phoenix began growing in the early 1900s, efforts to preserve the land around the mountain failed, and by the early 1960s, houses dotted the landscape. By 1968, the mountainous higher elevations were protected from development when Camelback Mountain became a Phoenix City Park. It's the show. I'm Nadine Arroyo-Rodriguez.
And if you've got ideas or hear things that make Phoenix unique, send us a note. The show at kjzz.org. It's almost time for the next episode of The Quiz Show. In 2 weeks, we'll bring back our resident quizmaster and Jeopardy! Tournament of Champions winner, Leszek Pavlovich. He'll face off against a KJZZ staff member in a game of trivia, but you can get in on the action too. Just solve this word puzzle. What five-letter word becomes shorter when you add two letters to it? When you have the answer, email us at theshow@kjzz.org. We'll randomly draw one name from the correct answers, and Leszek will play on your behalf. If he wins, you'll win a special KJZZ item. Good afternoon. It's The Show on KJZZ. The show is a stream of curated stories from Phoenix, our region, and stories from around the country. With the help of reporters and producers around the region and globe, we mix the stories and news to keep you up to date and entertained. For the next 2 weeks, a handful of playwrights are giving you a chance to talk back. Starting tonight, TheaterWorks in Peoria is hosting the New Works Westival. Four plays that are still works in progress will be performed, and at the end of each one, audience members will have a chance to share their thoughts and feelings about what they just saw.
How many times do you go to a play and you're leaving or a show and you have opinions that you would like to express? This is the opportunity to express them to the people who can actually make a difference and will respond to them.
That's Dan Shea, executive director of TheaterWorks. Since the plays are unfinished, they're performed with stripped-down sets and basic costumes, and the actors typically only have a few days of rehearsal to prepare. But the audience feedback helps playwrights polish their work. Local playwright Richard Warren has been involved in these types of festivals for years. He says audience reactions are valuable, but at the end of the day, the most important thing is making sure he's happy with his work.
If you are writing hoping to get every play on stage and or you're hoping to get to Broadway, forget it. That's not going to happen, or it's very unlikely to happen. You've got to write plays because you love to write plays. Do what you like to do, and that will make you very happy.
And if live theater makes you happy, you can speak up at the New Works Westival until Sunday, July 27th. While giving feedback is not required, this could be a good chance to release your inner critic and spare your friends and family.
Music parodies have been around for decades, from the vinyl days of Alan Sherman to Weird Al Yankovic changing lyrics of the biggest pop hits. But the Dan Band has gone in a unique direction, covering songs made famous by female vocalists. Here's the group performing Total Eclipse of the Heart by Bonnie Tyler in the movie Old School.
Turn around, every now and then I get a little bit tired of listening to the sound of my tears.
Turn around,
every now and then I get a little bit nervous that the best of all the years have gone by.
Turn around,
every now and then I...
The Dan Band, led by Dan Finnerty, will be at the Tempe Improv this weekend. Finnerty says the idea started with a positive reaction at a karaoke party on his last night with the musical Stomp.
The thing I'm woman and you light up my life and Flashdance. Some guy literally just came up to me and was like, do you have a flyer? I'm like, for what? And he goes, when's your next show? And I'm like, never. And he goes, well, I booked the Viper Room. And if you could put a 30-minute set together, I think it'd be really funny and, you know, I'd give it a shot.
Dan, you're married to the actress Kathy Najimy, who became known initially for the Kathy and Mo show on stage, which has a lot of strong female characters. So how careful are you not to make fun of women with the music?
I think anyone who comes and sees the show, I'm never putting down women. I'm never making fun of women at all. Like, I'm really making fun of us singing these songs. Like, how, a lot of times it's how ridiculous the lyrics are. Like, you really hear them for the first time when a guy singing them. So I think that's the fine line. If I was making fun of women, it'd just be stupid. And if we couldn't sing and we really didn't make it like a really entertaining show, the joke would be over in one songs. It wouldn't sustain itself.
Is there a song that you haven't covered yet that you really wanted to, but you thought, can't quite make that one work? Because I was even thinking, like, you haven't done a Stevie Nicks song, right?
No, she's almost too legit. You know what I mean? Like, there's no, we really stay in, like, the pop genre more than we, like, I mean, right now, like, to let you know where my brain's at, mm-hmm. I'm, like, trying to figure out how we're doing Wrecking Ball by Miley Cyrus, because I want us to be like swinging, you know, from the ceiling on these giant inflatable balls that come off, and then we bounce around on them. That, you know what I mean? So Stevie Nicks is a little too legit.
Dan Finnerty of the Dan Band, their mix of comedy and music, will be at the Tempe Improv this weekend.
And if the Dan Band's not your thing this weekend, plenty of other things going on. There's a family fun day at the ASU Art Museum in Tempe focused on comics, like the history of comic strips in print as art. There'll be art projects, booths, and performances with that. You can check out the Back to School and Health Fair at Metro Center Mall. 50 vendors, including free checkups, immunizations, entertainment, a light lunch, and more. There's an adult moonlight hike tomorrow at White Tank Mountain Regional Park. You can also have a book signed by Brad Thor at Scottsdale Civic Center Library. The New York Times best-selling author signs his newest book, Act of War. The show was produced this week by our senior producer, Sarah Ventry, with help from Bruce Drummond, Nadine Arroyo-Rodriguez, Tiara Vian, Kendra Sabo, and Caitlin Stein. Tracy Greer and Maria Springs are our digital team. Our managing editor is Al Macias, and our executive producer is John Hoban. We always want to hear from you. Let us know what you do over the weekend. Let us know if you have an idea for the Dan Band, anything you've got. Let us know good story ideas. We're at the show at kjzz.org. I'm Mark Brody. This is listener-supported KJZZ-FM Phoenix and HD. All Things Considered is next at 3 o'clock. Thanks so much for listening. Have a great weekend.